Honorable Member, can you get seconds so that we start with the one meeting? Good morning, Honorable Members, our guests for today, members of the public, if they are with us here, you are welcoming this Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform meeting, which is the first meeting after the Easter holidays, hoping that each and every member was in his or her church. Because it was time for us to go there and distress ourselves after the hard work. Honorable members were aware that this is the time where, as committees, were supposed to consider the APPs of the department and its entities to check their financial performance the previous year. To check what is it that they have planned to do in this financial year. But we are aware that we are not working alone as the committee. We have got Chapter 9 institutions that we are working with them. We are assisting also in monitoring or oversighting the performance of the department. We are also working with other departments which assist us, and also working with other stakeholders. As you've seen the agenda that has been circulated, that tomorrow we're going to get the briefing from the National Treasury and also from the Human Science Research Council. They're going to brief us. After the briefing, there will be some discussions so that when we consider the APP of the department and its entities, at least we've got information. What is their view with regards to the performance and financial performance of the department? Where are we supposed to pull up our socks when doing our oversight work? Without a waste of time, then the register has been circulated for us to sign. Kumla, do we have any apologies?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. Good morning, colleagues. I've got apologies from MP Kikana, she will join us later, and MP Mshongo is joining us at 10. Chililo Manenjo is running late. Thank you, Chair.
Those are the apologies. Can we note them and proceed because we don't have enough time? Can I then take this opportunity and welcome the National Treasury for being part of us today? I'm going to hand over this opportunity to Mr. Wilcox. Yes, to brief us.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Committee, for the invitation. It's my first opportunity to address the Committee. Hopefully, I will see you a bit more often. I think we're having a few IT problems by now, so we'll start off with the copies of the presentation if you should have them in front of you. I didn't introduce myself. My apologies. My name is Owen Wilcox. I'm the Chief Director of Economic Services in the Public Finance Division of National Treasury, and I've got the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform as one of the departments that we have oversight over on their budget. So just moving on to the presentation, if I can give you the headline story right at the beginning. It's the department is very successful at spending the allocation that they are given by the National Treasury. Spending is usually 98, 99, or even some years 100% of the allocation. That's not my laptop. Okay, I'll Absolutely. So, as I said, the department has successfully spent the allocation, which is that's not always that's obviously something that we look at the treasury is the allocation being spent. There are cases where departments don't spend the allocation successfully, so that's obviously the first hurdle. Going forward, we need to look at whether we can improve the way money is spent, whether we can get better value for money, whether we can improve mechanisms of spending or policy so that we can improve outcomes that are delivered from the allocation that we provide them with. So just moving on to the slides, the first slide is just gives you a very basic introduction. I'm sure everyone here already knows this. The department is pretty central to Chapter 6 of the NDP and to Outcome 7 of the Medium-Term Strategic Framework in terms of their contribution. I think we can flip over to the next slide, to slide number 3. We've got looking at expenditure and outcomes over the last 6 years. So the first slide is the outcomes from 2009. I hope everyone can read that. It's quite difficult to read that. It's just highlighting the main points that I've made already. If you look at the total line in the middle of the page, you can see that in 2009-10, the department only spent 92% of the allocation. So there was a substantial amount that was left unspent and returned to the Treasury. But that spending improved to 99% in 2010-11 and 98%, I think, in 2011-12. But my apologies for the table.
Mine is totally illegible.
Illegible.
Total, not partial.
I understand that. Sorry, committee, this is obviously illegible. I will provide you with a better copy that you can actually read. Sorry, I was trying to track quite a large table and split it across slides, and the outcome is clearly not acceptable. Okay, so I'll just try and run through it in terms of what we can see. Most of the five main programs in the department: administration, the National Geomatics Management Services, rural development, land restitution, and land reform. The two largest programs in terms of allocation are land reform and land restitution. They get most of the budget. In terms of the accounting classifications of spending, the major spending items are personnel and actually largely transfers and subsidies, and those transfers are mostly for land reform grants and for land restitution grants. I think the story I was trying to tell, which obviously doesn't work very well with the tables, is that spending has improved quite dramatically from that quite bad year in 2019. Moving on to the second slide, we can see that spending has gone up to about 99%. So in terms of spending allocation, that is great. As I said, we need to try and, going forward though, there needs to be greater emphasis on the quality of spending and value for money. I think moving on to slide number 5, it just reiterates these points. We've got 98% of expenditure, and restitution and land reform take by far the most, well, they're the largest programs, and obviously in restitution, the main issue. not sure the slides are white on the computer here, so I'm not sure why they're pink on the screen, and obviously that doesn't help with the legibility problem either.
Part of
any sort of land reform program, any country in the world that has a land reform program has to have some sort of extension and support program to the new beneficiaries. So what we've seen over the medium term is the department's aiming to acquire 1.14 million hectares of land and creating another 11,000 farms. Over the MTF, we've got an allocation of 4.5 billion. So it's 1.5 billion this year, 1.5 billion next year, and 1.6 in 18-19. I don't really mention this in the slides too much, but there is a, I think this committee has been concerned about the level of duplication of services between the Department of Rural Development and the Department of Agriculture in terms of support to farmers. So this is something that as Treasury we're very concerned with, is trying to reduce the levels of duplication and get the departments working a bit more effectively together, because they're both departments have programs that provide quite a lot of support to farmers. But obviously we need to make sure that support continues, but the question is, how do we do that more effectively, and where actually does the responsibility lie? Should the Department of Rural Development actually be doing this, or should it be an agricultural responsibility, and should the Department of Rural Development be focusing on the land reform mandate and the restitution mandate? But that's something that we will be discussing with the departments over next year. The Comprehensive Rural Development Comprehensive Rural Development Program focuses on three main areas. It's rural infrastructure development, rural enterprises development, and NARISEC, the National Rural Youth Service Corps. So over the medium term, we've got an allocation of 1.9 billion in 16-17, 2 billion in 17-18, and 2 billion in 18-19. The results we have from 2014 is that 6,841 jobs were created through rural development and land reform initiatives. In terms of NARISEC is we could call it a complement to the EPWP program. Program to provide employment opportunities in rural areas to support livelihoods but also at the same time to carry out the department's mandates in terms of animal and salt management. The NARISEC receives a budget of or an allocation of 1.3 billion in 16-17. 451 million in 17-18 and 395 million in 18-19. In 14-15, we had the department provided 2,200 community members and 3,000 rural youth with skills through the NARISEC program. So we're expecting the numbers to reach about 15,000 in the current MTF. In terms of the budget review recommendations from the committee, I think I'd rather just go backwards if that's okay. I'm more familiar with the recommendations that came through from the committee in the last 2 years. So it was in the 2015 recommendation from the committee was that the department should ring fence the allocation for new funds for the new claims, the new restitution claims. We actually did have a discussion with there was a discussion with the department. I think this was, I'm not sure when it was exactly, but the department decided to move. You must correct me if I'm incorrect on this. The department is moving ahead on claims on both sides, on the new and the old claims. So we decided not to ring fence the allocation. There has to be some sort of movement on the new claims that came through. Apologies, Chair. I did have the questions. I don't have the actual BRR questions. So the committee report was the Minister of Finance together with the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform should develop a funding plan with clear commitments to assist the Commission to clear commitments amount to the 6 billion relating to land claims that were approved before the 2015-16 financial year. The committee further recommends that commitments should be paid during the MTIF period in order to give way to new claims emanating from reopening of claims. So as I said, we didn't want to do the ring fencing based on what the department would want to their process for finalising claims. The second recommendation from the committee was that the Minister of Finance should facilitate finalisation of the development of an integrated funding and support model to land reform beneficiaries, smallholder farmers and emerging black commercial farmers. So that goes to that process that I was speaking about earlier, that we will be having trying to outline a process to reduce duplication between the Department of Agriculture and DAF and the Department of Rural Development, because both departments fund smallholders and provide extension services, and the Department of Agriculture also provides funding to the land bank for agricultural funding finance for smallholders. So in the next year we will be looking at the whole financial aspect of agriculture funding, and also who does what exactly, where responsibility lies for whichever departments. And the third recommendation from the committee was that the Minister of Finance should provide more funding to the Commission on Restitution and Land Rights in order for it to achieve autonomous status by the end of 16-17, and to ensure that it is adequately capacitated to provide services to its clients. And as far as I'm aware, it will be autonomous by the end of 16-17. Is that correct? We will have to engage on that, but I think there is funding for that to occur. Many of these recommendations seem to deal with similar areas in terms of restitution and budget issues. So my apologies, I'm just trying to download the recommendations from the committee in 2013. So the recommendation from the committee was the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform noted that restitution of land rights Amendment Bill 2013 is before Parliament, and once signed into law by the Department, the President will need more money to settle claims. The committee recommended that the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform should approach National Treasury for additional funding for restitution. That did occur. The Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform recommends that the National Treasury and Department of Rural Development and Land Reform should devise a plan to finalisation of all claims by 2014. Obviously that didn't occur as much as we'd like. What we did do was we did reprioritise money where it was available, if it was from underspending programs towards land restitution. And the third point was the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform recommends that the department should request more funding for the recapitalisation and development program. And National Treasury and the Department agree that recapitalisation and development should receive more funding. The request came through in, I think everyone understands the budget situation. It's been the same roughly for the last 5 years, that we don't have extensive funds to commit. So in this is obviously one of the areas where we feel we can do better in terms of using the money, but better across the two departments. And the last point from the committee was the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform recommends that more funding should be allocated for implementation of the Special Planning and Land Use Management Act. And the National Treasury and the Department agree that the Special Planning and Land Use Management Act is paramount in addressing inequalities in spatial development and settlement patterns. And as such, we did reprioritize 286 million for the implementation of the SPLUMA, the Special Land Use Management Act. So in terms of going forward, we have allocated in 16-17 10.1 billion rand for the for rural development, 10.5 billion rand in 17-18, and 11 billion in 18-19. It's roughly growing at inflation. It's not an allocation that's growing rapidly by any stretch of the imagination, but it is pretty much what all the departments are looking like at the moment. Allocations aren't really growing. I think the department will focus on the areas that they have focused on in the past. I think a new mandate or a new function for them is the establishment of the agri-parks that's come through in the last year or so. And they have devoted about 2 billion rand per year to that. And it seems like it's a 10-year program to establish one agri-park in every one of the 44 rural districts in South Africa. So just as a last slide, in terms of the overlapping duplication, that's a key issue that needs to be resolved in the next year, and hopefully it's something that we can take forward in the budget process as well, that if we can identify funds that are duplicated, we can also start reallocating them towards areas that are experiencing pressure in terms of the budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilcox, for the briefing. Members, you have been listening to this presentation with regards to the budget allocation of the department and also the entities back from 2009, 2010, 10, 11, and also 16 and 17. Can we talk to the presentation? Honorable Walters. I'm the chair. Honorable Sultana and Honorable Mngoni.
I thought you were a prioritized the honorable gentleman to my far right. Thank you. A few points for clarity's sake. Your opening remark was that the department has demonstrated an ability to spend all of its budget. But you'll recall that just the previous year, they had an under expenditure of close to 60 million. What attitude do you take towards such, especially given the reasons for that under expenditure? In this case, it was a case of poor planning. They thought they were going to train NARASEC members, and apparently not all the planning had been done as thoroughly as was necessary. What is your attitude in such cases? Because for us that was quite a serious matter, given the fact that when the department had an under expenditure of just over 5 million the previous year, I think 2014, we pointed out to them that we didn't like that. And I'll never forget the response that I got from the DG of the department when I raised concerns over that, and his remark was that, look, when you're handling a budget of over 9.5 million, what is 5 million? The following year, the figure has multiplied by over 10 times. That's why I want to know what your attitude is when a department underspends. When they were left, when we were left with about 1.5 months to the year end, to the 31st of March, they were here, and they already flagged three programs where they indicated to us that they do not think they are going to finish those programs. And impliedly, therefore, there was potential under expenditure. So we're expecting them to come back to us showing that under expenditure or last-minute reallocations. Now, we would want to know as this committee, what sort of pressure and corrective measures do you ensure are brought in, factored in, when such occurrences take place. I've heard you very clearly on your concern about the overlapping services, which obviously in care expenditure by the two departments, agriculture and land reform. This is something that we have mentioned over and over and over, both in the committee as well as in the National Assembly. Would you say that from this coming financial year, that is 18, 17 and 18, you would make sure that there is no such a practice again? Because it even confuses the communities. We understand that it's too late for 16, 17, but would you go back home with the understanding that we would love for you to make sure that this does not happen? In other words, you scrutinize the services for which they want a budget approval to say, no, so-and-so is already handling this. Please find another way of doing this. And lastly, Spluma. Okay. This question may be political. If you were not comfortable to respond to it, I will understand. How comfortable would you be to allow a budget allocation for the implementation of Spluma when it is continues to be surrounded so much by the controversy of the implied exclusion of the traditional leaders? They are clamoring for exclusion in this Spluma. But now, how comfortable would you be then as a controller of the finances, to continue to fund, a program that is surrounded by so much controversy? Because there's obviously going to be a lot of, irrational expenditure, shall I say, for lack of a better term. The chiefs have put their foot down and they say, this act will not see the light of the day, where effectively our powers have been eroded. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to everyone. I just wanted to really raise now that the costs are fashionable, what would have been a point in limine, to just ask the gentleman if Mr. Walcott, if you would really present in court papers this document and deem that the Honorable Court could be able to make any deductions out of it. In other words, Chair, the eligibility issue, I'm really quite concerned about. It should never be a standard. You should never bring documents that are illegible. We have a learned friend here who's always prepared to help me out. I am quite concerned about it. I look at you and I think that you've been in public service 15, 20 years and you're really quite a guru at it, and it shouldn't be, because you don't give us space to do oversight. That's why now we're talking everywhere. That would be one point. But when the others, like my colleague said, is that it is a debatable political question. We have emphasis on what we represent. Some of us would be very emphatic that we represent the electorate entirely, and not the chiefs per se, or some chiefs for that matter. And therefore, on the issue of the Spluma, which I talked about in my community meeting just over the Easter, we would be expecting more funding, and we would be expecting more support, because people are still continuing with land invasion, people are not literate, and even agricultural extension officers are still busy with some, continuing to cut sites and all that. We're completely at loss. So more and more work and more budget should really be going at Spluma. Pity that with my learned friend we're not at one on this issue, absolutely not at one at all. But if you have a take like he invited, I'll still be inviting, but from a very different angle altogether. That's just the vibrance of our democracy, I take it. thanks, Chair, but I would really like to encourage Mr. Olcott. This presentation is no presentation, but we appreciate that you presented yourself to be scrutinized, but unfortunately, you wanted to scrutinize the content. I'm having a difficulty, Chair. Thank you.
Chair, just three brief ones. I've noticed, recall about a year ago when you raised the issue of land claims and the number of projected land claims, the feedback we got, and with an actually Chair Cansard, was that the number of claims we're going to get, you know, it's not going to be around 400,000, that was just a consultant's opinion, you know, in 2014, and I see we're back at the number of claims of a projected 400,000 claims. So it seems like there's still to me, you know, what is actually the benchmark figure that's being used that hangs in the air. And I think it's a bit difficult because I think the real issue is not that claims can get registered, that we've seen a certain capacity being in place, but is the funding there and what is in place going forward? Because I don't see it in the medium expenditure frameworks, I don't see it in the budget, of funding the research and resolution of 400,000 claims. And we hear all kinds of we hear feedback of projections of up to 120 years of being at the current capacity that will take to resolve the number of claims. So I would like to hear a comment on that from a financial point of view. I'm not talking about the registration, the availability of officers to register claims. I'm talking about the capacity to research 400,000 claims and to fund the resolution of so many claims. What is, from a financial point of view, what's the comment is on that? I'm also interested to find out the remarks being made about a duplication of departments' works between the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. I'll be very interested to hear whether there's some type of a cost assessment of what the cost of that is. There might even be an argument, and I'm not taking a party position here, I'm not taking, it's purely a personal thought here, what the argument would be, has that been considered in terms of maybe not having different ministries here, but one ministry, and whether there's a costing that's been done that can be shared with us. And then a remark, and I don't think I'm saying anything new here, I think the committee, we've discussed this in the past quite extensively, there's a problem if you have reasonably good progress in terms of your expenditure, but it's not matched with the targets being achieved. So there's something... There's something there that bothers me. How can you achieve your expenditure target, but you don't achieve your operational target? So it tells me there's something wrong. Just at a overall level, and I think we've seen on our oversight visits, you know, what the problem is. You know, people spend. It's a kind of fiscal dumping. You know, farmers, for argument's sake, feeding troughs and tunnels are set up so that the department can say they spent their money, but it's not actually needed by the farmer. It's not actually what they want to do with their farm. So it's that type of thing that I'm very concerned about. So, yes, I would just want to hear the feedback to help educate me a bit more. Thanks.
I'm on budget allocation also that over the medium term page 14 under program rural development. The average growth there is 0.8%. I just want a clarity on that. Taking into consideration the importance of rural development. I don't understand that average group. That's what a clarification that is.
I think you've noted the questions as raised by members, but also on the issue of the IGP, what role is the National Treasury playing with regards to
2023 accounts. Then you've indicated the issue of the surplus. Each and every year there's a surplus. Why people on the ground are suffering? Can you just comment on that one? You also talk of the overlapping with regards to post-settlement support between DAF and rural development. What about the animal and felt management? Is there any overlapping between DAF and rural development? You also indicated that the commission is dealing simultaneously with the old and the new claim. Because our understanding is that with the new claim, they're just registering those claims. But the focus is on the old claims because they have to finish the old, they have to complete or finalize the old claims before, you know, processing the new claims. With the budget, that budget increase of the commission, viewing the challenges that the commission is having of the claims that have been settled, not finalized, of the new claims that are in court, you know, of the claims that they are busy processing now, do you believe that the budget that has been allocated to the commission is sufficient to cater? No, I'm not talking about the old new claims, I'm talking about the old claims. I think you said it correctly that the department has been able to spend more than 90%, 98%, 95% of their budget, but the value for money. Can you just comment? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. In terms of the underspending, the 60 million rand underspending, I mean, obviously we can't condone underspending that occurs because of poor planning. That's not something where we are, as government, are carrying out our mandate effectively, if that's what's occurring. At the same time, though, the 60 million rand is must be about 0.06% of the budget. So it's less than 1 cent on the rand in terms of the actual allocation. So I know it sounds like a large amount, but it's pretty much what we see with most departments. And these are departments where we don't target them in terms of as a problem with underspending. There are some other line departments that I'm not going to mention, obviously, that have larger issues with underspending, and those are the departments we work with very closely to try and resolve those issues. So, I mean, obviously, I understand that we need to try and understand why that happened. That 60 million rand is not it really is a very small number. Especially in terms of the government's whole budget, about a trillion rand. So, 60 million rand is fairly small change in the larger scheme. In terms of the duplication, I don't want to go on record saying that we'll do that end it by 2017-18, but that is the plan is to try and do that. That's what we're aiming for, is that we can try and resolve this issue, because it's been a long-standing issue and it's something that does need to get resolved. If I can just skip around questions a bit, in terms of the numbers of that, I think it's about what the combined budgets across DAF and rural development must be, about 2.5 billion a year, I think. That doesn't mean that the money's being wasted. It's just, you know, rural development supporting some farmers, DAF is supporting others, and DAF's got two schemes that are very similar. But the question, I think we just need a better usage of that money in terms of who has the responsibility for it and which department must it develop the capabilities to use that money effectively. I don't want to trade into politics in, terms of SPRIMA and the traditional leaders, I think obviously that for the department, if they want to get onto that. In terms of eligibility, I concede the point. I apologize wholeheartedly to the committee for that. I think, can I defer some questions to the department as well here? I don't know about the land claims story, what the numbers are. We've only got the numbers that we got from the department. I'm not sure if those are the most up-to-date numbers in terms of the 400,000. The allocation that the department receives for restitution includes, that money is used to research the claims. It is not, as I said, that's not something that, given the scale of the claims and what still exists, we're not going to be able to end that backlog over the medium term. This is a long-term issue, and obviously it also coincides with an issue in government as a whole that we're not able to increase funding to departments as much as we'd like to. I mean, obviously it would be great if we could come into the budget and just allocate a lot more funding, but we don't have that funding to allocate. So the question is, how are we going to fund the restitution program given our current constraints? And so part of it, given just looking at the departmental allocation, part of it is that the department's going to have to prioritize quite clearly within their budget. And it looks like, to an extent, this is what's happening with the slow growth of the rural development program. You can see that the rural development program is growing quite slowly, but restitution is growing quite rapidly. And that's obviously the department is taking a view there that it needs to fund restitution. In terms of the question of quality of spend, this is something we are concerned about. Clearly, this is the job of the National Treasury. We are, and as I said, this is something we're going to be engaging with the department over the next year, is to how do we improve value for money, and we do want to obviously see much better achievement of outcomes. In terms of the Ingonyama Trust Board, the role we've been playing up to now has been fairly small. It's something we would obviously have to look at. We can look into it in greater detail and report back to the committee if that's something you'd like us to do. We would need to look into it in greater detail, and if I can give you, I don't want to give you an answer that's a non-answer. I'd rather respond in more detail, and we'd have to look at this and understand what the reason is for the surpluses and why it is accumulating surpluses. They should be used for service delivery. Management, that will definitely be an issue that we deal with in terms of duplication. For the duplication, we're going to have to be very specific about which department carries out which specific mandates. Who does infant when you talk about the, I think we're going to have to go down to, it won't be like infrastructure is this, it'll be, you know, if you're building a fencing is this department's and whatever roads is other department's. And so animal and health management will fall into that process. All the new claims, I think it's probably more appropriate for the department to answer that. I'm not sure what their process is in terms of that. I think that I just alluded to in terms of the restitution, that it seems like what's happening is the department is saying that restitution needs is a priority in terms of given their current allocation, so they need to grow funding for restitution. We would support that given rural development obviously is a priority. There are many competing priorities, but there's only a limited allocation. So given that, there's a choice there between restitution and rural development. And I think it's important priority.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Do you have the follow-up questions? Honourable MacArthur.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know whether you responded well to the question of the programs that overlap in the two departments. What are still engaging with these two departments? What will happen to the budgeted items and period while you are still taking time engaging?
Any follow up? Over to you, Mr. Cox.
Thanks. I mean, the intention is to try and resolve it by next year's budget, so that we don't, for now, I mean, we've got a bit of there's a bit of a muddle happening on the ground in terms of who's doing what, and it's, that muddle's going to have to happen for another fiscal year. But the intention is that we, by the time we get to budget 2017, that we've got a much clearer outline of who does what. So that process is going to happen and be finalized in terms, in time for the new budget, that we can get a much clearer sense of what needs to happen on the ground.
Honourable Mandela. Honourable Robertson, is your hand up?
Thank you, Chair. I just wish to hope it's not a question that has been answered already. But perhaps if you can give us an inkling of how the integrated funding and support model will look like. Will it involve the land bank and other financial institutions? And where will the final political authority lie between the three ministries that are involved in this? And what is the timelines, when it will come into effect, etc.? Thank you.
I don't want to preempt the process that we're going to have to go through, but so it will have to include land bank. It's going to be part of the duplication process, because what's happening is the departments are carrying out their mandates differently. For example, Department of Rural Development uses grants a lot more. Department of Agriculture and DAF, they provide financing. And so you end up with, in some cases, those purposes, those two programs work against each other. So we need to take the model, the mechanism of providing agricultural support will also come into the duplication work. That we end up with a clear sense of who's doing what, but also an overall feel for how we will support agriculture, whether it's, who will provide the extension services, but then obviously it's going to have to include the land bank, because the land bank is doing so much work here already. So it will include how we finance support to agriculture, and including the land bank. I can't really speak about political responsibility yet, and I'm not sure about that one. And I don't, as I said, I don't want to preempt the process and tell you exactly what it's going to look like. Obviously, I've got some ideas, and we want to try and. But I've got some ideas, but I'm sure the other parties in the process will also have their own ideas, and I don't want to come in here and say this is, we're going to smart over the highway. That's not that approach won't work. So we need to, have as I said, it's a process that's going to occur, and sort of a negotiation between the departments as to how this happens. And timelines, as I said, we need to get this finalized as soon as possible. Hopefully within this, before budget 2017.
Thank
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilcox. Members, I think we have come to the end of this briefing and discussion. But let me just indicate that in future, I think members have just identified some of the things that need to be corrected, especially that documents, when we have been invited to the committee, documents must be circulated either a day before through our support staff for the members to be able to go through those reports. And I think we have realized that six of us here are using spectators. It means that we are getting older and older, so our eyes cannot see the faint figures. But as we have promised that we will resubmit the figures which are visible for us to be able to go through those figures and make some analysis. Honorable members, I think thank you very much. While we are waiting for the Human Science Research Council, can we have the 5 minutes break for them to come in? It's a break now. You can be excused. Thank you very much.
What's your comment over the refreshments we are having here? Is this justified expenditure? On a light note.
Honourable members, can we get settled and start with our second session? As I initially indicated that we are going to have another briefing from the Human Science Research Council. We've got Mr. Jacobs here with us who's going to make the presentation. I think the department is here just to observe and listen. We're going to meet with them on Thursday for the commission tomorrow and the ITB tomorrow. Mr. Jacobs, without the waste of time, can I then hand over this opportunity to you?
Good morning. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm very honored to be here and to make a presentation on some of the issues requested in the letter that I initially received. As the HSRC, we always welcome these requests from Parliament because we consider ourselves an evidence-based think tank that should be providing policy support to Parliament in various areas. My specific area and domain has been over the last 15-20 years on rural development, and so I welcome this opportunity for me to engage with the committee and members of...
Chair. Chair, I think we've just been advised by the National Treasury that we must have a presentation day before. But above all, even right now, I don't even have a copy of this presentation. It's a concern, Chair.
We noted your concern, but you must also note that this is not the department. We must just allow them to present what they want to present from us. They don't know our procedures. We've just requested them to come and assist, but I hope that if there are any to be circulated, the document will be circulated. I think it has been noted.
Yeah, thank you very much. So, of course, I was going to end off with the apology that we received a request to come to Parliament very late, or it came onto my desk at a very late stage, and so we were compelled to work on this presentation up until yesterday. So it was impossible for us to submit this overview a day or even 2 days before the time. But nevertheless, I hope it's clear enough and that we'll be able to stimulate enough conversation and debate and discussion. So there are a couple of issues that I'm going to address, and I call it usually three issues. Why is it that we're interested in this concept of rural development? Why is it important in South Africa today? It's a modernizing country. We're industrializing very fast, urbanizing very fast. Why waste your time in discussing rural development issues? That's the first kind of contextual remark. And in that contextual remark, the policy emphasis on rural development, and then we'll sort of move into the key areas of the budgetary and financial expenditure streams of the Department of Rural Development. The first element on why we're interested in rural development stems from this particular picture. It's not very clear on the screen, so I'm not too sure why it's so faded. Come out white and not blue or pink. Oh, is it the IT system? So I do hope that we get our presentation. So I just want to sort of highlight and emphasize two or three key things from this article that was published in 2014. And this article basically presented a 20-year overview of rural population trends and patterns. And so two things to observe. Firstly is that the absolute numbers of households or people living in rural areas, we are not seeing a decline in that. In fact, we've seen an increase in the number of rural households from 3.5 million rural households to 4.66 million rural households. Now, that's quite a steep increase of more than 1 million rural households. So the question obviously becomes, why have we seen an increase in the numbers of rural households over time alongside massive urbanization? And that is a big debate, I think, for scholars, but I think also for policymakers, because we have to take into consideration the implications for policy and specifically rural development policy. However, if we start taking this as a relative figure, looking at the share of rural households in the overall population, that is where we are seeing a decline. So that basically means that the rate at which we have an increase in rural household formation is not as fast as the rate of overall household increases in South Africa. So there are more people, but that increase in overall population is much faster than the increments that we're seeing in rural areas. The third element, I think, which is very, very important, and this is significant in terms of a big demographic shift, what we call in rural development studies, a big demographic shift in South Africa, is the decline in the average size of rural households. So rural households are becoming smaller. Traditionally, we've had fairly big and large rural households in the order of about 4.7 members per household, and now in 2012, when we did this analysis in 2014 with 2012 data, we discovered that it's now fewer than 4 members per household. And that, I think, is a significant development. So what we're seeing here is that it seems as if we are having household formation taking place, as Catherine Cross, my colleague, called it or termed it a few years ago. And then also, of course, the housing or the kind of settlements of rural households, that's also changing, that increasingly people are settled in formal brick dwellings, primarily your RDP housing settlements. So that development, I think, is definitely taking place and increasing. So there is this kind of mixed bag that we're having of rural development or rural demographic shifts, and we've got to take that into consideration, because that is a longer-term developmental consideration. The next important issue, besides the demographic switches and shifts in rural areas, it's more recent emphasis on so-called priority district municipalities. Now, here we need more accurate information on precisely where these are, but so we are using data that we've obtained from the Department of Rural Development as well as the Department of Agriculture, and we are doing a very intensive work in these areas for the Department of Science and Technology at the moment on trying to look at the role of science, technology, and innovation in rural development, or the prospects for that. And to motivate that particular process of work, we've asked the basic question, why would we be interested in science, technology, and innovation in rural areas? That stems from the low living standards in rural areas. So it's not only the demographic shift and changes that we're having, we're also battling with the living standard issue as indicated by basic monumentary poverty indicators, right? So what's the interesting observation here? Once again, there's two issues that we want to highlight. We focused on a whole host of these different districts, but we only displayed 4 of the priority districts. Umzanyati in KwaZulu-Natal, Dr. Ruth Mompati in Northwest, Chris Hani in Eastern Cape, and Mopani in Limpopo. And that's just a small sample of the 27 districts where we've been doing some very intensive low-level work and data gathering and collection and analysis. So the survey that we ran was in 2012. We're actually out in the field at the moment as I'm speaking, and we're running another survey. So the first one was to establish, are we really dealing with rural districts? Now, based simply on the demographic profiles, indeed that's the case, and we're using here demographic profiles as defined by the Statistics South Africa in their definition and classification of rural versus urban territorial landscapes. So firstly, in Umzanyati, 83% of the population in that district is classified as rural. In Dr. Ruth Mompati, 65%. In Chris Hani, 66%. And on Mopani, 86%, roughly. So in all these areas, we have a very, very substantial share of the population concentrated in what Status A classifies as rural areas. But more alarming is the column next to that called poverty rates. If you look across all the districts, the poverty rate in each and every one of those districts is above the average poverty rate in the province. So poverty is concentrated in the rural areas of those districts. In the case of Umzinyathi, 60%, compared to the provincial average of 45%. In the case of Dr. Ruth, it's 54% compared to the 43%. In the case of Krishani, it's 44% compared to 46%. In Mopani, it's 43% compared to 44%. So there is a strong poverty rationale for an emphasis on rural development, besides the demographic situation that we confronted with. Now, when we address this, we've got to take note of or be aware of the policy developments over the last couple of years or decade or so, and these policy developments have been very, very significant, and for us it's a very important starting point when we start thinking about the outcomes for rural people as a result of these policy developments. Now here we've got to add a caveat. It's very difficult to do impact analyses or impact assessments, even though the concepts of impact analysis or impact evaluations might be very popular in the policy domain. When you start looking at it from a research perspective, it's not as easy because you've got to apply very technical criteria and methodologies to do these kind of things. Nevertheless, when we look at the policies focus on four or five main, I think, policies. We separate them between macro policies, such as the NDP, the National Growth Path, Outcome 7 in the strategic priorities, as well as the National Development Plan, as I've mentioned already. Those are macro policy domains. They kind of fix the broader environment, and we compare that to what we call micro policies. Those are very rural development specific. And for us, the highlight has been over the last years the Land Reform Green Paper, which has kind of shaped quite a lot of the thinking and approaches to rural development and rural transformation. These are the list of priorities, and it is very interesting when you start looking at the extent to which they overlap, and the one kind of translates into the other. The emphasis has been on a number of issues, not only land reform, smallholder development, but also job creation. That has featured quite heavily. And in both cases, if you look at the policies, especially the micro policies more closely, they say, well, if we try and address rural development, we want to tackle living standards issues, poverty, inequality, and unemployment, better human well-being outcomes. So that, to us, is a positive message in policy. But the positive message in policy is not easily translated into the practice, into action. And this is where I think we've got to try and pay more careful attention. So what we now move into as the next part of the presentation, again, that kind of backdrop on why are we interested in rural development and the kind of embeddedness of rural development in policy, we want to sort of now focus and just switch to specific elements linked to the rural development budget. Why? Because if we look at the rural development budget in itself, it gives us an indication of the extent to which government is putting money next to its priorities. In other words, is the priority that is in macro and micro policies and emphasis on rural development matched by financial resources and financial investments? Now, if we look at this picture, which traces government's national expenditure over the last decade, over a decade from 2006-07 financial period until 2015-16, we see a very interesting picture. Generally, an increase, right? We see a lot of jumps, for example, around 2009-2010. Why are we seeing that jump? We don't know why we're having that jump. That jump could be explained because of the restructuring. That jump could be explained because of different calculations that went into nominal versus you know, real calculations of expenditure trends, and so forth and so on. So all those must be further unpacked. And to unpack that is not an easy task. It's very, very difficult, and I do hope that our colleagues, probably in National Treasury, they're in a much better place. And then we've got developments and trends over the period beyond 2013. Beyond 2013, we find a leveling off in expenditure and almost like a slight decline in the overall expenditure. Nevertheless, that is a general increase in the nominal expenditure if you have to put the one straight trend line from 2006-07 through to 2015-2016. Obviously, that trend line is not straight if we look at the actual figures. So there are these jumps and changes in what we call the gradient of the actual plot. Why do we have the gradient and what does the gradient mean? So what we try and do then is to look more closely at this figure by saying, well, okay, if there has been an increase in the overall expenditure, how does this compare to the expenditure in the budget overall? So is rural development really a priority? If we look at the next feature, that's the first step that we're trying to take in order to do that. So here we say, okay, if it is a priority, then what we would want to observe is as a share of the overall expenditure of the budget, it should follow that pattern and trend. Clearly it doesn't follow that trend. Actually what we're seeing is as a share of the total expenditure of the government, rural development expenditure seems to be declining and seems to be falling. And this is very important and an interesting observation from our part. So, and it should not be viewed in isolation from the demographic and policy issues already mentioned earlier. But we said, okay, well, that is not enough. Maybe we should hammer the data a little bit more. Some people say, well, you try and hammer the data until the data begins to confess. We're not trying to squeeze a confession from the data. We are just trying to sort of say, okay, what does it mean? Where does it fit in? So we said, okay, it's not, to see it relative to the overall budget is one thing, but can we just say something about the trend in itself? So that's another way of hitting the data for a confession, or beating the data for a confession. And here, when we start doing that, we are compelled to say, well, and come to a first kind of conclusion that the picture doesn't look very well. It doesn't look very nice. And it sort of captures that overall kind of trend that we mentioned earlier, that the rate at which expenditure changes is changing very, very fast against rural areas. And this is what this picture is saying, that the year-on-year change in expenditure is actually shrinking. And this is very alarming if we look at the spike around 2010. When 2010 happens, we've got the restructuring and increasing emphasis on rural development from a policy perspective. But the rate at which we are spending on rural development priorities, it's declined absolutely and very fast. Actually, over the last two, three financial periods, we're actually in negative territory. We're cutting back expenditure on rural development for reasons that we still need to probe and study a little bit further. And these are very substantial declines. That is why you find the blue trend line below zero from about 2013 onwards. So the year-on-year of change becomes very bad. So that's the overall picture. How does it compare to what we have in the different line or line items or different programs? Okay? That's the next question that we want to address. So before we look at some of the specifics, here is the graph that gives us for the four, I'm not including here administrative and the other department, which is calling the geomatics and deeds. I'm not including those two. and focusing on the three main streams: land reform, land restitution, and rural development. So what do we have here? The two top lines, the red line and the black dotted line, they are the two lines of what we termed 10, 15 years ago as the so-called scissors situation. At that time, our research was primarily focused on the rights-based versus the redistributive-based forms of land transfers. The rights-based is the restitution one. The redistributive one is the land reform line. At that time, we came to a conclusion as academics, generally, which I think we were incorrect, where we started kind of making arguments around trade-off between the rights-based and the redistributive-based strands of the program. I don't think we were correct at the time. And I think now we're in a better position to either say yes or no to that kind of hypothesis or hunch. And why is it that we're in a better position? Because we are seeing both strands declining and falling off. Once again, falling off in a period where we are supposedly, from a policy perspective, placing greater emphasis on rural development, specifically the land transfer component. So both redistributive and the land rights-based transfers seem to be contracting from a financial transfer perspective, and that is why we see both those lines very, very steeply falling off. But what is very interesting is the bottom green line that's kind of sloping upwards. That's the rural development one. So is it the case where rural development, broadly speaking, is becoming a priority in its own right? Is it the case where rural development is taking away resources from the other two or the traditional streams? Or what is happening? Once again, as academics, we are unable to answer that question, so we can't give a precise answer. But what we do know from policy documents is that the department says that it is focusing on a host of different items, specifically recent strategic spending priorities: the recapitalization program, the agri-parts program or program or initiative, the one household, one hectare program or initiative, and of course the strengthening the rights-based intervention through the expanding and extending the lodgement of land claims, and then the National Rural Youth Service Corps program or the NARISEC program. Now these are very, very important specific interventions. These interventions have gone through a whole host of different evaluations and assessments and impact assessments, some yielding very informative and enriching results, others questionable results. I don't have enough time to go into all the detailed analyticals on every one of them. Of course, the newer ones, especially those that have not been in place for more than 5 years, are very, very difficult to evaluate, because standard evaluation theory suggests that a rule of thumb is that a program younger than 5 years, it's always very, very difficult to do a proper impact assessment. And then there is the other element, that impact assessments can be done at a variety of different levels. The one part of impact assessment is on what we call the outcomes for the beneficiaries, the outcomes for individuals who are supposed to be benefiting from the programs, rural households, broadly defined. That requires long-term, longitudinal data which we do not have and which we are not investing in, and that's a concern. So as scientists, we want to help, but we can't help if we don't put resources into that kind of area of work. The other part of evaluation or assessment, which is much easier to do, is what we call implementation process evaluation. Implementation process evaluation focuses on evaluating whether a program is implemented according to its intended objectives and targets. Now, that is fairly easy to do, But once again, it gives you very high-level results and findings. For the next couple of slides, I want to just give a quick snapshot of the individual line items per spending program. So I will begin with land reform. And in the land reform program, the emphasis has really switched or shifted to spending and investing an increasing amount of resources in the bottom line item, the agricultural land holding account. And this switch or shift coincides very strongly with the switch towards the proactive land redistribution approach or proactive land acquisition strategy, as well as the recap focus. What we see in the classic redistributive reform mechanism, which is the LRAD, SLAG type grants, those ones have really contracted quite sharply in the last year, so we see a consistent decline there. The others are not that significant, and so we sort of present a very quick summary of this in 4 or 5 points. The approach to land redistribution stresses state ownership of farmland and land reform beneficiaries, farming on the basis of a kind of leasehold system. We find that about 62% of the expenditure is now allocated towards the proactive land acquisition strategy by the state, and that we are seeing a persistent fall or contraction in direct land grant transfers to beneficiaries. Recap, which is also part of agricultural land holdings, we need a little bit more detailed information and data there, but its aim is really laudable, but we don't exactly know what the outcomes have been to date. As I indicated already, we've got a whole host of different individual type case studies, but that doesn't add up to really anything at all. Restitution is the next element, and restitution is really focused on the giving land grants to the purchase of land or, of course, the other types of rewards or awards that's been offered through the land restitution program and process. I'm sure there might be great interest in how well the land restitution reopening process is working. And, I mean, here we have to rely quite heavily on, I think, media information that's being reported, and that would be fairly well known. Now, what I want to do next, before we get to the conclusion, in order to allow for a couple of questions that I might and clarity, is to focus on a kind of case study that we conducted to begin to fill some of the gaps on what we call the land transfers, both the rights-based and the redistributive-based land transfer programs. So we're on slide 15 at the moment. We're on slide 15 at the moment for colleagues with the presentations in front of them. I'm now switching to slide 16, where I'm doing the case study, which is a HSRC survey on land reform and rural poverty that we conducted with a small amount of money from the Department of Science and Technology. Okay, this would be the slide after land restitution data. Okay, so it's titled HSRC Survey, Land Reform and Rural Poverty in 2012. The Department of Science and Technology gave us a very tiny grant to do a very quick survey of land reform beneficiaries with specific emphasis on the extent to which the land reform program is helping to overcome some of those difficult challenges or problems that I've listed in the beginning, the demographic issues, the living standards concerns, and so forth. And this survey was then conducted in a number of different districts. We covered about 6 districts across 3 different provinces, and we've collected data from 301 land restitution and redistribution beneficiary households. And this was the first survey of its kind to do what we call an overlap study. What we mean by an overlap study is that it uses the redistributive household or the land recipient household, and then it sort of builds over that through, very intricate survey design element, the extent to which this household has also received what we call agricultural development support. state-funded agricultural development support. So there are the three categories that we focused on state-funded agricultural development support. Is TASP, RECAP, and MAFISA. Now, RECAP was very new at the time, and so we were kind of conscious of that. So in other words, this was the first survey, and I think the only one of its kind, to test this hypothesis. Is land transfer on its own helping people out of poverty, or do you need land with agricultural support to get out of poverty? It's the second hypothesis that we were interested in specifically, because just giving people land, historically, if you study the lessons from other parts of the world, whether it's in Africa or Asia or Latin America, it's just been proven over and over that land on its own it doesn't do the trick. If you dump people on land, you're not changing anything, really. You've got to enable people to accumulate. This is the concept that we use in land and agrarian studies, to accumulate. So I can give a lot more detail on the technical methodologies used in this particular study, which covers a whole chapter of about 20 pages for those who are interested in spending some time on what they call it, HRC statistical gymnastics. But let me sort of focus on the findings. Gender equity is a main focus in policy. What we found was that more than half of all the respondent households received land via LRAD, SLAG, and a small percentage plus, which was also fairly new. 54% of the households responded that men were more likely to own land distributed through the land reform program than women. Now, in KZN, for instance, we managed to sort of subdivide and do more localized level of analysis with the data set. The sample allows us to do that. 70% of the land transfers took place to males, in favor of males. Right, so people would be concerned with the first case, so what's happening to the 46% and what's happening to the 30% balance. In those cases, we had a whole host of different mixed landholding arrangements, male and females holding land. Right, but it's pretty varied across the sample. 60% of households in the Northwest reported that females and males own land together, which is well above the one-third. So you see this kind of variation. So there's no consistency. And so you forced as a scientist to ask the question, so why is there this kind of big variation and what is it that we're actually targeting? Then we sort of did this interesting analysis. Yeah, where we said, okay, the extent to which households are benefiting from agricultural development support is also pretty varied, so there's no consistency across the different provinces. So here we give the provincial results, we aggregated it up to the provincial results, we sort of kind of don't bring it down to the district levels. But it's very interesting that there's quite a heavy focus on CASP, the different elements in CASP, and across the different provinces, different parts of CASP seem to be and emphasized. In Western Cape, for example, there's very heavy emphasis on giving the new farmers or land reform farmers training. Yeah. In KZN, it's just giving them inputs, you know, variable or fixed inputs. In Northwest, it's on-farm infrastructure. Yeah. And then there is the land reform recap that we tried to sort of incorporate. At the time, it was very tiny in terms of the recipients and beneficiaries. And this might be for a whole host of different reasons, perhaps the slow implementation process of the program itself, being a new program, but also the extent to which people have benefited from PLUS or PLAS. And that was pretty fast-tracked in a place like Northwest Province. So there, PLUS was fast-tracked, and this coincided with, you know, a large number of recipients being beneficiaries of the RECAP program. In other provinces, that that kind of didn't feature very, very much. The question that we have here is that to what extent is there departmental integration between DAF responsible for CASP and DRDLR responsible for RECAP, and how can we have greater efficiencies from the resources invested here? We then highlight some of the emerging concerns. The first one is that when we start focusing on agricultural farmer support programs, is that we've got this skewness in benefits. The skewness in benefits for us is a concern. Why? Approximately 76% of households indicated they have benefited from at least one form of state-driven support, but 20% have received two types of support. So there's a strong overlap among within a fifth of the sample. Yeah, 4% of the households reportedly, obtained three types of different, clusters and categories of support. And the last point is the point that I've already highlighted in the data slide, that the plus farm of farmers dominated the dominant recipients of RECAP, with almost 70% of them indicating that they have benefited from this particular program. So RECAP is largely kind of ring-fenced almost for the plus farmers, even though we are aware of the fact that roughly 30% is kind of going to others. The application process to us was also a big concern. So besides the skewness in beneficiation, that there is this kind of group of people who seem to be accumulating, we don't know if it's at the expense of the rest, and we don't know what criteria they're using to sort of fund people, is that farmers tend to, there is no what we call upfront support. There's a loaded concept which is called post-settlement support, a concept that we do not like at the HSRC, because it means that you first transfer the land, and then at some point after the transfer of land, post-land transfer, you worry about agricultural development support. We say that there's a need for upfront development support. But the majority of the farmers, actually almost all, they're still dependent on a very long waiting period before they get any other form of support. And that was based on this particular sample. The kind of support received from the different departments also very, very, very varied. In some cases, DAF comes in and Department of Agriculture, they would give support, and in other cases, there's a very limited reliance on rural development for support. In many cases, in the Western Cape, for example, the tendency has been to appoint a mentor, and these mentors, they mainly the old farmers, in other words, part of I think what became then incorporated into RECAP as well. I'm coming closer and closer to the end now. This, to us, was a big concern because it's linked to a broader kind of rural development trajectory, what we call, is it leading to accumulation? And here what we did was, now we have two distinct categories of farmers. Some are farmers who are not receiving agricultural development support. Others are farmers who are receiving agricultural development support with land reform. That's the group that we are focusing on. And there are very distinct patterns here. For those who are not receiving agricultural development support, they are not really the ones who are really accumulating. We see quite starkly that the farmers who are receiving agricultural development support are the ones who can sell a surplus into the markets. Yeah? And that's the group, I think, that is moving ahead quite fast. The ones who are receiving agricultural development support are the ones who are farming to raise an income. 43% or 44% of them answer that this is what they do. Whereas in the case of those without agricultural development support, their emphasis is securing food as the main purpose or additional food as a secondary purpose. So it seems that if land reform is really about just securing food, whereas if you have agricultural development support, that is when you really can accumulate, when you can become a farmer in the true sense of the word. So a small percentage of the farmers are really getting a foothold in the market. And if you do not take that into consideration, the transformation of the agrarian system in South Africa is really very far away from actual transformation, if that is what we're aiming to do. A few slides and notes on rural development, and then I'll conclude. In rural development, obviously, especially after 2011, or maybe 2012, 2013, has been the flagship rural development intervention, the NARISEC program. I didn't do a clinical analysis of all these, and I note that the middle line item has now been more focused on the rural industrial and enterprise development program, RIED. But that analysis can be done further. The key point that we want to make here is that there is now an emphasis on NARISEC, and of course the focus in NARISEC is about the training. The trouble is, when you have NARISEC, it is the same as any other public employment type based program. How do you actually transition people into longer term employment, and what do we know about the program in that regard? We know very little, and we'd love to know more. This is just giving a much broader outline of the data. It's the same as the previous picture that we've discussed, and just to emphasize that there is the increasing focus on rural development spending line item that by the 2012-2013 financial period, 13% or 12% of the budget already went to rural development, with a very heavy emphasis once again on the NARISEC program. I have 5 points in conclusion, and these 5 points are not necessarily limited to the budget. They go slightly outside. It's that the first point, if we look at rural development spending in a broader context, it's still hovering around 1%. Yeah? And the concern, as I indicated in my first couple of slides, is that we've seen a contraction there. It's now below 1%, so 0.7% actually. The second point, which is a big concern to us, is the fragmented nature of rural interventions. What are the roles of different government departments, or how do you integrate them? How should that be working with the RDLR? The socioeconomic changes that result from these, it's very, very difficult to see. So it is not very, we can't come to any firm conclusion that these interventions are definitely changing the demographic and the living standards conditions there. They might be on the margins, but in the core structure of rural development or the rural landscape, we are not seeing any fundamental and real changes. And we are concerned that there is not a real empowerment happening. You know, rural citizens should be able to drive development on their own. I mean, we have wonderful ideas on IDP, participatory development, LED, but how do we incorporate those kinds of commitments into rural development policy specifically in the 27 districts that we, and then rural development is a very complex process, and it's very dynamic, it's changing all the time, and so there is no notion of, we've gone over that 50 years ago, I think we sort of got out of that kind of linear trajectory of rural development, so, you know, rural areas will just decline and urbanization will take up everything, and that if you want to do rural development in the right way, you have to focus on context-specific interventions, and that, I think, is the future. And context-specific interventions require a different kind of evidence base than this kind of broad overall picture that we could present here. We wanted to give a more detailed and nuanced analysis at the provincial level, but this is where we have to stop. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jacobs. Members have been listening to the briefing. Can we talk to it? Honorable Walters, Honorable Nguni, Honorable Filton, then we close.
kind of information that we actually need before we make policy. So I really welcome the initiative to invite. I think there's established a solid research to be shared here, and I think I think one of the things that we got from some of our previous workshops I recall from PRAS at GWC was the absence of real data in the field, and I think this is the kind of thing that we need to really start targeting interventions and making a difference. So I really would like to welcome it, but I also think, is it possible to get the actual report, the actual research, if one can look at it more closely, to inform ourselves going forward?
Chair, thank you very much. I would have loved to stay for the rest of the interaction on this, but unfortunately I've got a prior commitment for 5 to 11. I think it's gone past 5 to 11, Chair. But I just want to join colleagues in really appreciating HSRC. You opened up our eyes. I value the presence of the department. I wish the DG, however, was also in, because some of us have always emphasized the graphical representations because they really point to the problem areas and help policymakers and even the executors, implementers, to be able to really know where we're going and so forth. And I think our eyes have been opened up, and thanks. I'm a student of a general knowledge, by the way, and I appreciate it when you said the data can be hammered up until it speaks out the truth. You know, not going to start on a light note, but really we do appreciate your work, and I think we'll go even thoroughly much more, because had we had the benefit to get the presentation beforehand, we could have been able to perhaps interact in much more dynamically. But I think we'll infuse it into our work. It sounds very solid and objective. Department is listening, so you will know where we're coming from. I think that's a good point of departure. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. When I was in Canada in 2009, America was battling to define rural. When I was with a development agency called Dinga in O.R. Tambo about the same time, rural was being defined as poverty-stricken areas. Would you say, or how would you define rural today? That's my first question, given that background, especially with regards to the socioeconomic status of rural areas vis-a-vis the urban areas. I'm asking this question because you pointedly remarked that in specific rural areas, the poverty levels are much higher than the averages of the provinces, which means that when you factor in the urban areas, there is an improvement thereon. But now, because of the historical apartheid situation in South Africa, which part of the urban areas actually impacts on this? In other words, are we not misleading ourselves in thinking that people who live in certain areas are actually rural, when in fact townships themselves have become rural, except that the type of housing that they have, that you find there, is different from what you normally experience in typically rural areas? Second question, you remark that you are not investing in assessing the outcomes of the spend on rural families, something to that effect. I may not have recorded it as accurately as best as desired. For me, that is where the real rub of the whole exercise lies. Time and time again, I have asked the departments and the various institutions that come to us, why, when are we going to get a report on the socio-economic impact of the annual spend? And now it seems like we're getting closer. What attempts have you made, and with what amount of success, in trying to get a budget to do this? Because your concluding remarks point us to a direction where unavoidably we've got to conclude that all the expenditure, that's the expenditure that the department is incurring, is not actually yielding the desired results. It points in that direction according to your conclusions. But you said that you are not spending much money in that. How do you then come to that conclusion? The one that you know, indicates that the socio-economic situation has hardly improved when you say you are not you know, spending much there. Lastly, I've time and time again suggested that even though rural development seems to focus a lot of its energy and spend on typically agricultural, you know, activities, why not broaden the basket, mix it? Would you recommend that the department begins to move in that direction? Perhaps we could see a much improved, you know, type of result insofar as the socio-economic situation of those rural families is concerned. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair. And once more, your presentation has opened our eyes, but you can still open them even wider. Thank you.
Honorable Mandela, you're the last one.
Thank you, Chair. I will be very, very brief. I also want to welcome the presentation, but I will wish to agree with Honorable Nguni in relation to the DG, but with a slight amendment that the DG, the department, should seriously consider somehow redo or repeat this research that has been done in 2012. However, the sample that has been used must be broader than the one used in 2012. I think the results will be very, very much more informative and very significant in relation to what the department is trying to achieve today. Chief, if you don't mind me slipping out. Thank you.
Honorable Chabeling, then Honorable Makaja will be the last one.
Okay, thanks, Chairperson. Let's first thank you and your team for having invited the HSRC to our meeting, and thank the HSRC for the work that they've done. And I wish that we had this document before so that we studied and be able to engage and ask, you know, penetrative questions for our own enrichment. And I'd like to plead that this should be the beginning of many other meetings that we need to hold with the HSRC, even if it means us as a committee sometime going to meet with them if they cannot come here, because I think they have something that we need. And this will help us going forward in broadening and deepening the theater of rural development. I thank you. I just hope this is not the first and the last meeting that we meet with them, and that this information, following on what the Honorable Walters has said, that we should be favored with the research document, all of it, if it's possible, and that it should again be shared with the department, so that when we engage, we'll be moving from the same understanding of what is at play. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Sir President. I wish to align myself with my colleagues for appreciating this HRC presentation. To me, it's just a comment. I'm commenting on your accuracy about your research. You know, on agricultural development support, it is said that according to CASP programs, EKZN is focusing only in production inputs. you are paid for it. How can we balance infrastructure and training support with that input? You know, infrastructure and the training support is very sustainable. So if they can balance that, not the inputs only. Thank you.
Mr. Jacobs, most of the issues raised by members were comments, especially appreciation for the presentation, but I think there are just one or two that needs clarified.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I think the first point is that we'll make all the papers underpinning this presentation available. We would have made all those papers available had we known ahead of time or prior to last week when I received the call to make the presentations available, as well as all the reports. There are about 5 reports underpinning this presentation, and they will all be shared with the committee. I will make it my duty as priority when I get back into the office now to send them out. And these reports contain a lot of the more detailed answers to a lot of the questions raised, including the question on defining rural. We do not have a concept called rural in our constructs. We refer it to as what we call rurality, because we take it that all these areas have degrees of ruralness in them. And there are 3 important underpinning concepts or indicators used for this. The first one is what is called population density. The second one is called infrastructure development. And the third one is called the natural resource orientation of the economy. In other words, whether labor is employed primarily in your natural resource-oriented activities. So in these 3 indicators are also indicators used consistently to define degrees of rurality in the Status A definitions. So we can also make that available. Now, so in other words, we are not defining rural purely in terms of agriculture or in terms of poverty and poverty nodes and poverty indicators. Then I think if we focus on one or two of the other comments is about how do we get to the conclusion that you know, the impact or the spending items or investments have had little impact on rural households' living standards. Well, there is no study that is proving the converse or the contrary, that these interventions have really transformed on a broad scale the living conditions and living standards of these areas. And in the absence of those studies, if we look at the 2 fundamental issues that we were interested in, living standard trends, poverty trends, as well as demographic trends in these areas, then we are bound to at least come to some kind of initial conclusion that we cannot, you know, at this stage say precisely or conclusively that the existing investments have had positive return for the communities in these localities. In other words, we are asking the same, or we are requesting the same as what the honorable members are requesting, that we must invest in more thorough, credible, and reliable long-term research to get to firm conclusions about rural development and the state of rural development in these areas. Indeed, and this is my last point, we concur with the conclusion based on our limited survey that there must be greater balance when it comes to agricultural development support packages and programs. But our question goes slightly beyond that, and we ask, so how can this balance be obtained? How can we get to this balance? And we say that requires what is called bottom-up rural development strategies. What that basically means is we have to ask the rural population what they want and what they need. Top down imposition of solutions, which is just getting rid of the budget, spending, I don't think that's going to get us anywhere. I think the kind of smaller or deeper institutional dimension is what we have failed to address. So as I indicated already, they're very well documented in LED strategies, IDPs, and so forth, but do we translate it into action? And that, I think, is what is needed going forward as the first step to bring about transformation. Let the rural voices be amplified, and let us take those needs into consideration when we do interventions. And that will be the first step, I think, towards radical rural transformation from just a slogan, I think, to something in really indeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, I think we have come to the end of this meeting. Thank you very much for the informative briefing, and I hope that time is against us.
No, sorry, Chair. I'm not going to prolong the meeting. In fact, we can come back to this issue in a future meeting, but I think the issue of research and research-led interventions in the rural space, I think, is something that, because there's a hugely important matter that were raised here. And if I could suggest then we come back to this in a future meeting just to discuss.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Honourable Members. Honourable Jacobs, thank you. Mr. Jacobs, thank you very much for the briefing and the presentation. It was really informative. The unfortunate part of it is that we've got limited time, but I think this is not the beginning. We're going to invite you in other meetings, and I hope that the report, the five reports that you've promised to send to the committee, will be submitted to PUMLA. Then it will be circulated to members. Thank you very much, and also to thank the department for being part of this meeting. I know that we're not invited, but you feel that you have to be part of this meeting and listen to the presentations that the committee will be having today. Thank you very much for that. Honorable members, tomorrow we're having a meeting, the presentation from the Auditor General's office, and also from the DPME. Thereafter, we'll engage on the APP for the Commission and the APP for IGP. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.